meeting.
Okay. Moving into item number four, the director's report. Director Unsworth, I will turn it over to you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. A few items today. I don't think we'll take the whole time, but we'll move through some. First off, thanks for all of the public that showed up, and welcome to our new facility. And I want to start out by having John Long, our regional director here in Ridgefield, talk to you a little bit about the building. And I think we'll have some opportunities at lunchtime or sometime. John, we can give you a walkthrough if people are interested. This facility is, we've just been here 5 or 6 months.
A little over 6 years.
It's a huge improvement of where we were down. I think we were in an old Fred Meyers building, and we had all kinds of problems down there with security and inability to keep our equipment undercover or protected. And so this has been neat. And if you get a chance, walk through it. We're pretty proud of the new building. And go ahead, John.
Yeah. Well, just welcome to Region 5. That's Southwest Washington. My name's John Long, and I am the regional director here in Ridgefield. So just to orient you where you're at, so Ridgefield is the home base here for Region 5. Region 5 is 6 counties in Southwest Washington: Lewis, Cowlitz, Clark, Skamania, Klickitat, and Wakayakum counties. We've got all the programs represented here in the region, and the staff here are excited to welcome you all and the public to the facility here today. Of course, we've got fish folks in the room. There's a lot of sturgeon research and a lot of salmon and steelhead research that goes on in for the Columbia River, as well as tributaries and inland fisheries as well. Of course, there's wildlife folks. We've got 3 wildlife areas in the region: Shillipoo, St. Helens, and Klickitat. And so we've also got enforcement as well. You might remember that there was a recent very large case involving illegal hunting. That case was broken right here in this region by regional enforcement staff, and we're really proud of them for that. And of course, we've got our habitat program, not just things like HPAs, but they work with folks like the ports, some of the major ports, and provide them with scientific recommendations where they encourage conservation-based measures for some of the port activities in these major ports. And the director already mentioned one of the most exciting things that's been happening around the region here in the last year or so is this building. And this room is my favorite room in this entire building because we can do a lot of outreach. We can host public meetings like today. And there's a lot of technology that we can use to leverage better public input. And we're excited to embark on those journeys as well. And as the director mentioned, there's a lot of other advantages here that involve storage space for things, sensitive equipment like boats and whatnot. Would be more than happy to take any of you on a tour. Just flag me down and I'd be glad to do that. So welcome. Welcome from me and welcome from all the staff here in Ridgefield.
Yes.
Thank you. Could you give us a picture of some of your hot button regional issues?
Sure. We've got issues surrounding a lot of fisheries issues, as I mentioned. So sturgeon management, salmon and steelhead policies that you folks direct us on. A lot of things surrounding wildlife, that illegal hunting activity. There's things like hoof disease that are central down here in this region. And of course, those port activities that I mentioned are really big deals. There's lots of very large ports that have different functions in the regions, and so influencing their decisions is of utmost importance for conservation measures. And so, those are some of the key things. Some other cool things that you might want to know about the region is you can see some of the places that you can see things here that you can't see in a lot of other places. Like, if you watch out that window there, you may be lucky enough to see some sandhill cranes land in that field. We've had that experience here a number of times. There's other sensitive species like Columbia white-tailed deer, western pond turtles, etc., and not to mention the fish issues as well. So there's a lot of opportunities going on down here, both for commercial, recreational activities, bird watching, all kinds of things that are accessed in this area, and I'm excited to be here.
And John, while you're here, I wanted to let it be known a special thank you to Jana and Martise for helping us set up Assistant Tammy. It's a lot of work, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll relay that, and thanks for being here. And if you need anything, just let me or the staff know, and we'll be glad to serve you.
Sure. Did you have Dave had Commissioner Crable?
I got to talk to John a little bit in the hallway yesterday, and one of the exciting aspects of this facility is the technology that's available here for video conferencing, if I'm saying that right.
Yep.
This is probably the most advanced facility in terms of that technology, but it's something that we need to explore and expand so that all the different regions and even commissioners and the public can communicate. And so you've got the state of the art here, and I hope that there's efforts to duplicate what you're able to do in the other regions and Olympia. So just to make things more efficient in terms of communication, I think that's something that Don's mentioned before would really be an advantage in terms of being able to communicate with the public and internally.
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner. That you're absolutely right. We do have the at least the best that I know of in the state system, in the department system, and it involves the screen behind you and the camera behind you and the sound in this room. It's all enabled so that it can be computer streamed, like in through a WebEx or something like that. And if we had that capability in other parts of the state, that would be really powerful in terms of being able to enable public and enable advisory group meetings that would be not mandating travel so much, but leveraging technology to enhance our ability to interact with the public.
That's great, John. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Great. All right. Thanks, John. I'll tackle a couple of other items. I recently went to the Western Association Fish and Wildlife meetings, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but just a couple hot topics from that meeting. Chronic wasting disease continues to increase and expand across the country. It's something that all hunters and sportsmen should be interested in, and there's considerable research being done. It's cropped up in many states now, and so lots of states, Washington included, have limitations on how you can bring meat back if you're a non-resident hunter in another state. I just think we all need to think about that and be careful if when we visit other states. Washington currently does not have chronic wasting disease, nor does Idaho, but it just cropped up in Montana. It's pretty much statewide in Wyoming and Colorado, and that's actually some of the first places where they found the disease, but it's also spread around the country, associated at least in part with game farms. And so it's a disease that manifests itself later in the life of a deer more than early, and so people are looking at some maybe new management techniques where you would manage for lower, younger age deer populations, and that might help a little bit. That does run counter to mature deer management, which we all like, I think. So anyway, lots of trade-offs, and more on that. Kind of keep your eye on it. It's an interesting story and something that I think all hunters should be interested in.
Director?
Yes.
A couple of years ago, we had federal funding to do screening for CWD, but that funding has gone away, so we're no longer doing those. We were doing them at the voluntary biocheck stations. It's a wake-up call when we heard about I think elk in Montana. It does move. It's getting closer. I just sort of raised this for the commission and maybe your input, but or Eric's or somebody. Is it worth thinking about reinstituting screening, maybe at the state's cost, is this horrible prion is obviously moving closer.
Given what I heard at the WAFA meeting as well, that it is coming, so anything that we can do, but to,
yeah. Yeah, Eric, do you have I know we have a response plan and whatnot, but.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioner. Yeah, on that, we have had recent discussions on this topic, and certainly in light in the movement of the disease. Surveillance and looking, trying to detect the disease is important. We would like to know, the public would want to know if it were to come into Washington. I've challenged our staff to first come forward with a clear understanding of what the response plan would be for us to have a program out that actively, voraciously looks to try to detect the disease, and not understanding what our response would be is a little bit problematic. So we need to pull the two together, and the science is a little different from, you know, efforts to fully remove deer populations in Wisconsin and how that didn't work, to how you manage the herds and old age class animals or not. So there's a lot of discussion to be had about the response side, and I think we do need to have those conversations, but they need to come hand in hand, because to embark on a surveillance effort for detection without understanding what we would do as a result is problematic. But we need to have those conversations. It's time, and our staff are having the preliminary discussions behind the scenes to come forward with what that would look like.
Thanks.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, and since we're talking disease a little bit, I do want to at least mention our hoof disease issue. It's worse in this region than anywhere else. It's the challenges of eradicating or dealing with a free-ranging wildlife population that has a disease like that are very difficult. We're taking it seriously. Last year, the legislature provided some funding for Washington State University. They're in the process of hiring a dedicated professor to work on the disease, and so I'm looking forward to more attention being paid to our hoof disease problems. And I don't know if anyone's in the audience that have been here in the past, but we are making progress. It's never fast enough for any of us, but I'm glad for the extra attention we're paying to that. Another topic at the Western Association meeting was the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. That legislation has been dropped. What it does is provide a Pittman-Robertson, Dingell-Johnson funding source-like source for species of greatest conservation need. The funding source is offshore oil and gas revenues. The legislation was dropped in the House by Fortenberry and Dingell, I believe, and so we're working with our congressionals to see if we can move that. Why is that important for sportsmen? Well, it's important because it would provide a funding source for these animals that aren't hunted and fished, and for the list of species that aren't ignored, but we need to pay more attention to, because they're many of the ones that end up on the endangered species list. If we can learn more and get ahead of that, we can prevent listings, and I think that all helps us do our regular management. As we all know, we have implications or challenges from the Endangered Species Act every day, and particularly in the fisheries world here in Washington. So we'll track that and provide more information as that legislation moves. I wanted to just mention southern resident killer whales. We've been working closely with the governor's office to look for ways or things that we could do immediately to try to bolster or help killer whale populations. We're at a level that at the lowest level in Puget Sound than we've been for about 20 years. And so we're watching closely. Some immediate actions that could be taken would be to increase for food. And so the governor in his budget, he's provided a budget item, I think it's $3.1 million for operating, and about $800,000 for in the capital budget to do a few things, and the few things that impact Department of Fish and Wildlife. One would be to increase salmon hatchery production and a few hatcheries that would provide more fish in the Sound. There's obvious side benefits to that for fishermen. But also there's funding there to work on fish screens in central Washington, and also to enhance some of our enforcement efforts to keep whale watchers at a proper distance away from whales. The capital budget, I think some of that was for hatchery improvement. And so more on that as we go along. I think what we've been told is the governor is going to make some kind of announcement in February. He's working to assemble a task force and to get more people focusing on this issue, and I think it will help all of us and help fishermen too to have more fish in the system. Yesterday I mentioned this, but I'm so proud of it I want to mention it again because I have a room full of fishermen. The department has finished we have an app available for you to use with your smartphone. It's in iStore and on the Google store. I don't use Google, but whatever your app store in Google, or it's called Fish Washington. It's a GPS-enabled application that has our fishing rule. So if you're standing on a lake and looking out there, you can get into this app and toggle the water, touch the water where you're looking at, and it'll tell you the fishing rules for that piece of water. So it's really, really pretty amazing. I was mentioning yesterday, I've been an experimenter or a beta tester on this thing, and I've been enjoying the heck out of it. The other day I was on the hump tulips on a section I hadn't floated before in my drift boat, and it was really handy. Halfway through the day I was able to see where I was at, and we have all of our boat ramps on there, and so I could tell how much I was going to have to row in the dark because I was going too slow. So anyway, it's a backup GPS for you, and it's also provides these rules. Check it out. Please run it through make it work, and then provide us feedback if it doesn't, because this where we're at is in the initial testing right now. So it'll only make it better the more you guys use it and gals and give us feedback. But it's really cool. I think you're going to love it. And it's a way to simplify rules. We've been working on that, and we're going to do some of that in the commission meeting today. But you can't get much simpler than really knowing what you've got, where you're standing. So pretty proud of that one. I want to do a quick legislative update from the director's office. Nate, will you do that?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Director Unsworth, Nate Pamplin, Policy Director. And just want to touch on a few highlights from this 60-day session. Of course, today we're closing out the second week of a very fast-paced session, and it has been busy. Our two agency request bills are moving along. We had a hearing on Wednesday in the House Ag Natural Resources Committee on our rec recruitment bill. As a reminder, that bill accomplishes four things. It aligns the youth and hunting fishing age to be 16. It removes the requirement to have an annual license during the first few days of the Lowland Lakes trout opener. We provide a $20 discount to graduates of our Hunter Ed program. And it allows the commission to bundle licenses, and it allows the director to offer promotional authority. So all of those concepts are really trying to get more people hooked on the outdoors, getting folks out hunting and fishing. So it's a real positive bill. There's a companion bill in the Senate that has a hearing on Monday afternoon. Our ADA bill, House Bill 2649, also had a hearing on Wednesday morning. This bill consolidates a few statutes. Your existing rulemaking authority on ADA provisions is going to be combined into a single statute, and it removes, it broadens the authority of the medical professional that can certify an individual is disabled. We've also been getting out and talking to members about our supplemental operating budget, trying to highlight the needs on the early marine survival study on steelhead, the needs that we have in enforcement to replace our and update our 10-year-old CODI system, our enforcement records management system, and some other IT infrastructure. And also we have a request that you all approved in September that didn't make it in the governor's budget regarding some veterinarians to help us with fish health package. And so that's something we're just wanting to make sure members are aware of that need because of the new federal and state requirements of having veterinarians be closer to our hatchery facilities and overseeing the prescriptions and husbandry of fish in our care. Some great news last night is that the capital budget and the bond bill was approved. That provides $57 million in projects for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and $17 million in grants and federal local authority. Also, two really neat things that were included in that for provisions is it's retroactive to July 1st of 2017, and the legislature is allowing agencies to JV, that is to move funding back from expenditures that we incurred on the operating budget and move them on to the newly adopted capital budget. So a big relief for us, a lot of important projects here that were on pause. If the capital budget wasn't approved here soon, we might start losing our opportunities for doing construction in the work windows, as well as we had approximately 100 staff that were relying on capital funding. So that's pretty nerve-wracking when you're looking at probably around March, we would be going into a reduction in force if the capital budget wasn't approved.
Yeah, thank you, Nate. That is really good news. I was chatting with Deputy Director Storr this morning. Apparently, and you're still trying to read the budget and see exactly what it means for the agency. I expect, I would anticipate that once that analysis is done, that you will be notifying the commission, kind of an update and what it really means.
Sure.
So. Okay, good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Kehoe, yes, it's essentially the capital budget that we had last year. The version that was passed last night does not include three supplemental requests, the Herd Creek Hatchery, the Scatter Creek Historic Buildings and in response on fire, and the piece that Director Unsworth mentioned regarding hatchery improvements accompanying the southern resident killer whale efforts. So we'll need to visit and try to understand what the legislature's intent will be about kind of a perhaps a supplemental capital budget to the one that was just adopted last night.
This session.
Correct. Yes. Not sure what's going to happen with our ability to try to move some of those emerging needs forward. So,
okay, good. Thanks.
But we'll keep you posted on those. Also, last night, the Hearst, a bill on the Hearst decision came out that allows for wells, and that was one of the big leverage points on moving forward on the capital budget. Certainly, that has implications for in-stream flows and fish habitat. That bill has an accompanying $300 million mitigation package with it, so we're still trying to figure out the details associated with that bill. Just a couple other items just to highlight. We worked with a number of interested legislators to help write a fix, if you will, for last year's commercial fee bill, House Bill 1597. So this year, there's a bill, House Bill 2626 and Senate Bill 6317 that increases the non-resident fee for commercial fishers by an additional $385 above resident fees. And it, we heard a lot from, there was a proviso in our operating budget about guides, and we had seven public meetings and a couple workshops with guides this fall. And we heard quite a bit that the guide fees for food and game fish guides were increased too much in 1597, and so these new bills reduce those rates. And then there's three bills associated with Atlantic salmon net pen bills. One calls for additional study, one does a phase out, and one does a ban. The department's been engaged in just trying to provide technical expertise on Atlantic salmon management, aquaculture, the relative risk, and certainly that's an important policy call on behalf of the legislature. So that's all I have for an update.
Thanks, Nate. For the rest,
Sorry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In our briefing materials, here is a document titled Orca Recovery, Budget Period 2017-19, Budget Level, Performance Level. It seems to be talking about increased hatchery production for the purpose of helping out the killer whales. And one of the pages talks about, mentions cowlitz hatchery here in Region 5. So could you speak a little bit about what that's all about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McIsaac, yes, there's the package, the $3 million in the operating budget, $800,000 on the capital, has a number of provisions for hatchery production increases. It's not just within Puget Sound. It also includes Willapa and hatcheries on the Columbia and the Cowlitz. Trying to look at all those areas that where facilities may have an opportunity to increase production but not be impeded by Endangered Species Act requirements. We're currently going through an effort to try to tighten up those numbers. We're hearing from members kind of thinking, looking at that amount for southern resident killer whale recovery and trying to figure out how to tighten that amount up, because there isn't that much general fund going around, and that's a sizable request. So we're putting pen to paper to look at the hatcheries that have the room and the freeboard to increase production, but also mapping out the killer whale distribution year-round and where our hatchery stocks are going, to make sure that we're investing in hatcheries that could actually potentially serve as forage for killer whales. And that's about everything I have on that particular issue. So, Commissioner McIsaac, maybe you could probably grab Kyle Addicks or Assistant Director Warren if you had further questions.
Just a question on the timing and in the context of the future. So is this something for this legislative session underway now to deal with, and is there so is this an immediate situation, and is there a process for additional considerations for future years that might include consulting with the state of Oregon, for example, and looking not just at what's if this is an immediate, where is there a hole in a hatchery somewhere that could rear some more fish, but being a little more creative?
Oh boy, Commissioner McIsaac, I think that's a great question, and yes. So in the governor's proposal, he's planning to establish a task force, and when we've talked with Office of Financial Management, they're not interested in doing more research to try to identify and clarify the threats to southern resident killer whales. That's been studied. We know them. It's now trying to assemble those folks and the agencies and the tribes and other stakeholders that can spend their time focusing on implementation. And certainly, I think the creativity here, while it's Washington-based, we're wanting to have NOAA involved. We're wanting to bring in British Columbia. And I think, as you pointed out, working with other states, I mean, southern resident killer whales will feed off the mouth of the Sacramento. So there's a lot of areas that we need to try to boost their prey availability.
Nate?
But this is just immediate. This business now is just immediately, and there is a process for further...
Correct. So this would be this is a supplemental request that closes out the end of this biennium, so through June 30th of 2019. That task force would be offering recommendations. They're supposed to try to have their report done next fall to inform the 2019 session for the future investments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nate, I don't know who to address this question, but I wanted to get some insight into maybe what's going on in British Columbia. Any similar movements? Because they certainly have a much greater geographic capacity and habitat than we do. I would assume we're working together or in conjunction with them.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Carpenter, yes, British Columbia has this fall been establishing a number of work sessions, intergovernmental work sessions, to try to look at what can be done. So it's a real complementary effort. They've invited staff from WDFW to come up, and certainly the Southern Resident Killer Whale Reliance on Fraser River bound Chinook during the summer is critical. So that's a key player in solving this issue.
Thank you, Nate.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Penny Becker's here. She's been one of our lead person working with the governor's office on this. Penny, if you have any details, quick ones you'd like to add?
Hello, Chair and members of the commission. I think Nate did a great job of explaining. I think the one thing I would put forward is Canada has this Oceans Protection Plan that came out through their federal government this last year, and they're dedicating about $1.8 billion towards that plan. And Southern Residents is put forward as one of the three species that they're focusing on and putting a lot of those dollars. So on many fronts, we're working with them on everything from looking at vessel disturbance and things like shipping to the fisheries side and contaminants and everything in between. So, yeah, they're absolutely a critical part across boundary.
Great. Thank you, Penny.
Thanks, Penny.
All right. Joe's going to give us a quick update on where we're at with our diversity group and also a little bit on our youth efforts.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Director. Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning, public members. Great to see so many people here. We have been working pretty intensely in the last 3 or 4 months on some improvements to our internal work environment, and that's all about making our workforce more inclusive, more diverse, building more respect in the way we operate with each other internally as well as externally. That's proceeding along two different fronts. One is our senior leadership, our executive management team, and we're planning to get together with the next layer down in the agency, our regional program managers and our division managers, to talk about ways to advance this effort. In the meantime, we're talking about training, recruitment, various types of improved communication to show that leadership is making this a priority and that we are, you know, we have a plan in terms of how we move forward. We also have pulled together, and I've talked to you about this before, a diversity advisory committee, which doesn't include any of these senior level managers. It's kind of a grounds up sort of approach. About 25 staff members from all backgrounds, walks of life, that represent the entire agency. We pulled those folks together in December 12th. A lot of energy, a lot of excitement, a lot of need to get past the storming and forming kind of phase of any new group and get to specifics in terms of a work plan. They've got their next meeting set up for 2 days. They wanted more time than the 1 day we had in December. So we've got 2 days set up towards the end of February where we'll have all of those folks in the room and expect to build on that energy and make some progress there. So that's a real exciting thing, and we just spent some time at our executive management team yesterday doing some more internal training and some more internal discussions. The other issue I wanted to talk briefly about is a follow-up to past discussions, past requests that you all have had of the agency around youth involvement. And wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we're doing. That we've got lots of interest in reaching out and a lot of staff involved. We are looking towards this coming spring when our community relations folks and marketing team are going to be using the modest funds that we have to develop a community relations and marketing plan that focuses on reaching youth. We'll use the we've got about $140,000 in an account that is earmarked for youth initiatives, and so we'll use a small part of that to do this, build a strategy, build this plan, and we have been using that to do a number of activities. For instance, this last year, let me read a list of things recently took on the National Hunting and Fishing Day event at Camp Piget this past autumn. Was well attended, and I think that was the second in a row, and we're seeing increased interest and increased participation. We have school event partnerships with Cabela's this past spring. We participated in family and youth-oriented events in the Seattle metro area, JBLM, and Spokane. We did some work with locavore-oriented promotions focused on younger and food culture-oriented people in farmers markets this past summer and spring. We have ongoing work with the League of Women Voters to create conservation-oriented social studies curriculum for youth in Washington schools. We have hunting clinics, and we mentored hunts focused on youth throughout our hunter ed, through our hunter ed department. And we're doing some social media marketing promotion efforts. So just a slice of what we've been doing in terms of youth promotion with the modest funds we have, and want to involve you as we put this plan together this coming spring.
Thanks, Joe. As you know, I'm very encouraged by this discussion about youth, and I throw that out to my friends in the room, all of us with the gray beards and the gray hair. Take it upon yourself to get youth involved. That's our common denominator future for all of this, and for the future of fish and wildlife in the state of Washington. So we're trying here, but this is not something that we can just do without all of you and the clubs that you represent and the organizations that you represent. I think that's a thing that can unite us all. So thanks, Joe.
Just a few more comments. I want to talk a little bit about transparency. The department's been getting cuffed around a bit recently by several people about transparency, how we don't do things in the open. And so I'd like to address a couple of areas in particular. First off is our negotiations with the tribes. Every year we do our annual North of Falcon negotiations. It's almost a year-round negotiation, actually. We meet with tribes year-round, the co-managers, and work on different fisheries, try to set objectives, and then try to promulgate these fisheries within the limits set forth by NOAA. And it's a challenge. The tribes are sovereign nations. That's how they function and work. They are the people that can allow or not allow people at their meetings. We work, and this board and others work under open public law, and we do that and follow it very carefully. But when we work with the tribes, if they want to have a closed meeting, the meeting's closed. Our choice would be to not meet and not come to any kind of management decision, or to meet with them and do the best we can to communicate what goes on in those meetings as quickly as we can. And during the North of Falcon process, we put in an extra effort to provide downloads to all of our constituents throughout the day. And some of you have been at the North of Falcon meetings and the PFMC meetings, and I know that you said there's a lot of downtime, and then you get a download during the day, but we truly try to do our best to communicate as best we can. Another item of transparency or questioning the department recently has been our development of the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Resource Management Plan. This was a court-mediated discussion. Part of that mediation was confidentiality. It allowed, I don't know if any of you have been involved in mediation, but it's a standard practice, whether it's to resolve a business dispute or a divorce. Confidentiality is part of that. You can get things done or accomplished within that legal framework more quickly than you can otherwise. But those discussions are that just what they say, confidential. That's how the plan was done. The commission was informed that the planning was occurring. I erred in not providing more detail to the commission about some of that. However, you you know, you have to weigh what can we talk about and what is important to maintain trust within the negotiation to come to a final decision document or management plan that will work for folks. There's going to be several of you today come up and talk about your fears and anxieties about the Stillaguamish and the constraints that may have on Puget Sound fisheries. I share those constraints, or I share those fears, and I share your anxiety. Believe me, after going through the 2016 fishery, when we did not get a resolution to our North of Falcon, I got a lot of slaps on the back right after we came away from that. We didn't make a decision. The slaps quit in a hurry, and all of us realized if we don't get our act together and work together, we're not going to have a fishery at all. And that resulted in this process where we worked with the courts to come up to this decision. Yes, we have some conservative elements of this from a conservation standpoint. Yes, it's appropriate to be conservative, and to some extent the chickens have come home to roost with some of our populations. These Chinook have been listed for many years now, and we've been reducing our harvests, and we're still below 40% population-wise from where they were when listed. So there's some real conservation issues, and I want us all to remember that, because we are all conservationists in this room to a person. And so also that what's going on are negotiations with the Pacific Salmon Treaty. This is our negotiations between the southern U.S., Canada, and Alaska. It's between U.S. and Canada, but sometimes it feels like it's a three-way negotiation with Alaska. The Canadians take over 50% of our mortality on many of the stocks that are of concern. Upwards of 60 to nearly 70% of some very important stocks. Part of the negotiation that we're working on with Canada, again, confidential negotiations with a sovereign where you're not allowed in the door, neither am I, because I'm not a one of the people, you know, assigned to the negotiation, will have a big impact on where we're at into the future. But I just wanted to talk about that. I wanted to be as open as possible. I want people to know that we do what we can to try to communicate and provide all the information we can as soon as we can about the broadest areas that we possibly can. And I know you have some questions. I welcome that. I think we all would like to have total open government. Believe me, I would love to have observers in some of the meetings that we have, because the department has sometimes endured some things that I don't think would have occurred if there was open meetings. Anyway, nevertheless, I just want to finish up that I'm looking forward to your comments today. We're going to consider everything we can. We're going to do whatever we can to manage ourselves out of a difficult conservation situation. But at the same time, the department has got to, like one of our former governors said, extinction is not an option for us, and we're going to do what we can to maintain all of the stocks, and including some that are going to pinch us and cause us some pain. So with that, I'd like to finish my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Yeah.
Can I just thank you, Director. I want to echo that I strongly believe that we, as a commission and also as a department through advisory committees and many other vehicles, try to be transparent. There are constraints. I sometimes feel this discussion about transparency is a little bit of kill the messenger. We have a mission that says we will work to protect and conserve fish and wildlife while providing sustainable opportunity. To me, first and foremost is the conservation, because we can't provide sustainable opportunity if the wildlife goes away. And in Puget Sound, for 18 years, we've been under ESA constraints and have seen the populations decline. Conservation has to be the concern. And I think we have to sometimes deliver bad news, and it's hard to do. And I just sometimes have felt that this discussion about transparency has been disappointment with the news that we have to deliver.
Thank you. Then we'll pick back up on the Wildlife Committee report.
Thank you. So we met this morning, bright and early, 6:30.
Thank you. We discussed, first off, various bills, as Nate was suggesting, some of those bills. I won't go back over those. But we also talked a little bit about some of the other bills that have come in. There's a translocation notice and public hearing notice if any animal, such as a coyote, cougar, bear, anything gets translocated. That's a bill. There's some killer whale bills, one on task force, one on captivity patrols, and a go slow bill. There's another bill on wolf translocation that would immediately call for that. There's several marbled murrelet bills in the makings as well. We had another discussion on sharp-tailed grouse. I'm not going to go into that too much because we'll be having probably a good, healthy discussion of that right here. There was some discussion of the commission gets involved quite a bit on these species reports and where we're headed with a variety of species, and maybe that we should maybe have almost a workshop on the WACs around listed species, and the ESA process briefing might be in order at some time, where we could even involve some of the advisory councils, such as the Diversity Council and others, maybe Big Game Management Council too. And again, we'll have more discussion on sharp-tailed grouse with the full commission today. We had a quick rehab update. There is some legal actions going on there, so we really couldn't talk about much. But they are working on some type of resolution. That's basically what was said. And it includes reviews of the animals, the processes, everything that's going on with that rehab situation that you've probably all heard about. And then we backtracked a little bit to issues from old, but that are still important. We talked about cougar mortality by PMU or CMU data. We had a printout that was, it shows a lot that some PMUs are above the quota before they get closed. It's almost natural. There's areas that have a high element of cats that by the time, and people have tags to use on cougars while they're out hunting, by the time a certain period of time goes by in a hunting season for deer and elk, you know, there's a number of cougars taken. So they were talked about that, and it wasn't just from that standpoint. It was also talking about, are our quotas too high or too low in some areas? Because, as we discussed this a few years back, the population data is so hard to pin down. You know, it's not an easy thing, and more research could be thrown at it, but I think you'd still come out the other end with saying, like, population of cougars is just a little bit of an unknown in places. And the best science will give you a good estimate, but, you know, maybe there's some things we could look at there. And also a discussion on cougars that are taken from a safety standpoint versus cougars that are taken from a hunt standpoint. Do those numbers get lumped together at the correct time to evaluate cougar numbers and what's being taken and what's not? We had another quick discussion on bears and timber companies goings-on. Again, there's some legal stuff going on there. But I think the gist of that discussion was how the department is really trying to use some of this conflict transformation process in that and trying to get through this in a reasonable way. I would say that I can't think of anything discussed in this morning's meeting that couldn't have been discussed right here and kind of backing up the transparency issue. However, yesterday we had a good, healthy discussion about, because we were listening to you and we heard some discussion about, should these committee meetings be open to the public? So I think what we decided, and we're still discussing this, but is to move and try that out. You know, let's try out all committee meetings open to the public. It doesn't affect us as much as it affects staff quite a bit. You know, our time, I'll still be at a morning meeting probably on wildlife. The big difference is there won't be any ham and eggs there. So, because we usually eat while we're doing this. And I would say you probably wouldn't be able to feed all of you if you decided to come to one. So there's the logistics of that, you know. But if an agenda goes out and you see a topic that is of interest to you in a committee, you can certainly come as we're planning this. Like I say, unless there's some committee member that had a cell phone go off during a meeting and had to bring donuts, there's no food for you. And you'd have to fight for those donuts with us, I think. But I think I'd want to just cover that. And generally speaking, I think we're going to give that a try. And, you know, we're just going to see how it goes. If it really shows that we're less efficient or it's costing the department a lot more money, that may be worth it. You know, if the public says, boy, that's great that we can come to these committee meetings. If nobody comes, I guess we'll probably readdress it, you know. And so, like I say, a lot of the things that get discussed there of a lot of interest, you probably get discussed here at some point or another, but we're going to give that a whirl and see how it works.
Thank you. Thank you.
Could I just add?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Any other committee members?
back to the rehab center issue, the other thing that we talked about is prior to the incident with, for heaven's sake, the department actually had opened the rehab rule, and this will be coming before us. It had been recognized by the department that we really needed to take a look at that and kind of update, and then the incident happened. But we, the commission, will be seeing that within some months. And I think it's important to know that while this happened, the department had already recognized that we had some issues with management of rehabilitation facilities.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to comment on previous comments by Commissioner Thorburn. I go back in time because for 30 years I sat on the other side of that table as a stakeholder. And I think often we don't give enough credit to the stakeholders that are sitting out here in the room. The fishermen most often are the ultimate conservationists. They're the ones that are paying for much of what we do across the budgetary issues related to this agency. And I think we got to try and figure out a way going forward to give them a chance to help us. I don't think we reach out enough to solicit help from the public as we attach blame. Sometimes we find a fix, but I think we need to reach out and establish some really distinct partnerships going forward, because without that, I don't think there's a future that's going to be beneficial to any of us. And so I hope we can work on that.
Well said. Yep. And part of that was what I said earlier about the youth initiatives. So that's our common future there. I know we